The White House also has to consider the political cost of health care changes. The president's approval rating is not as high as it was a few months ago.
And on health care, one poll puts support for the president just below a majority. It's in that atmosphere that President Obama holds a primetime news conference tonight.
NBR News analyst Juan Williams is in our studio. Good morning, Juan.
Good morning, Linda.
And Juan, I want to read you a quote from a Republican here, Senator Jim DeMint. This is a quote. If we're able to stop Obama on this, it will be his Waterloo. It will break him. That's the quote. What are the odds of getting Republican support on health care when that's how some lawmakers are thinking?
Not very high. And another leading Republican strategists say this is the time Republicans can go for the kill. And what they're looking at, Steve, is they're looking at poll numbers. Poll numbers like those from Gallup that indicate 50% of Americans now disapprove of President Obama's handling of the health care issue. In fact, the Washington Post ABC has a poll out that since April on health care, President Obama's standing has gone down from about 57% to 49%. And if you look at it, a lot of it has to do with the cost. Right now you have about 44% saying that they think that government-run health care will increase their cost. 63% think it's going to lead to higher taxes. All those numbers suggest to Republicans that this is a critical moment for the Obama presidency, and that while his popularity has been driving much of the support for health care, maybe they could attack some of those policies now.
Although you just got on one of the complexities of this debate, if people in surveys are being asked about government-run health care, if that's the actual phrase being used in the poll, the administration can say, that's not what we proposed. We're not proposing government-run health care. But, of course, still you have the confusion in the debate.
Absolutely. And I think that's one. And you have the focus on cost, that people are increasingly, this is really interesting to me, it's independents who are flipping right now on health care, if you look at one group, and in particular people who make more than $50,000, because they think one of the key elements is it's going to drive up their taxes.
The president's been talking about this day after day after day. What happens, do you think, when a president seems to stake everything on a single issue?
Well, this is very important for him, Linda, and very important right now, because this is the defining issue of his very young presidency. He's had some success, of course, on the stimulus package, even yesterday in terms of the vote on the F-22 in the Senate. But everything now is on the table. If we were playing poker, you know, it would be all the chips are down on health care. So how far does he go? Because he's got a majority in the Senate. He's got a majority in the House. And the question is, does he push them? Does he push the timetable? Does he say, you got to do it before the August recess? Does he let them go until the end of the year? Does he give in on some of the key elements of his plan? All of it, really, right now is going to define what he's able to do going forward beyond this issue on energy, for example.
Do you think he needs to be nervous about the Democrats?
He's very nervous about the Democrats, had Democrats over the White House yesterday. And again, it comes down to whether or not Democrats feel that this is about just President Obama, and or is he looking out for the team? Is he looking out for the Democratic Party going towards 2010?
Well, on that point, Juan, how does it affect the president's role in these detailed negotiations that he says he's trying to leave the details as much as possible to Congress?
Well, it has hurt him to a large extent, Steve, because what he'd hoped was he was avoiding the President Clinton, Hillary Clinton trap going back to the early 90s by laying out something that critics could go after. But allowing everybody to have their own ideas has also then allowed a sort of cacophony to develop around town, and everybody picks at one specific item. People start then questioning whether or not it holds to President Obama's campaign promises, and the result has been sort of all over the table, as opposed to something that's concerted and allows the president to say, here's where I stand, here's the line in the sand that I won't go past or whatever. And right now he's trying to regain that by having the press conference tonight and then all the interviews he's been giving, trying to once again sort of take the reins of the health care debate. That's what we're seeing taking place here.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams, thank you.
Linda, Steve, good morning.
From bicycles to bats and balls, Commentator Frank DeFord says there's a secret to the success of some of the top teams in baseball.
You want to win at baseball? Easy. Hire an old guy to manage your team. In this youth-dominated world, it's old-timers' day every day at the top of the baseball standings. The National League, in particular, is like an advertisement for AARP. The Dodgers, best team in the majors, is managed by the oldest manager, Joe Torre, who just entered his 70th summer. In the Central Division, St. Louis is on top thanks to the aging wisdom of the 64-year-old Tony La Russa. And leading the East, the world champion Phillies are managed by Charlie Manuel, who is 65. Manuel twice heard doctors give him up for dead. He managed the Indians a few years ago while wearing a colostomy bag. You can't run the guy off. These champion geriatrics remind me of what Maurice Chevalier said in his dotage. I'm too old for women, too old for that extra glass of wine. All I have left is the audience, but I have found it is quite enough. The National League also boasts three other graybeards in their 60s. You could hire the whole bunch to do those interminable sales pitches for old people's remedies that dominate the network news commercials every night. Fixing their dentures, going to the bathroom at their leisure, and taking the right medications to ward off dementia. The average age of National League managers is almost 57, and hey, that's supposed to be the league where more brain power is required because there's no designated hitter. They don't call it the senior circuit for nothing. Not that the American League managers are all spring chickens either. The Central Division leader is Detroit, managed by Jimmy Leland, who is 64. That means that by the end of the year, four of the six division-leading managers will be eligible for full Social Security benefits. The coaches in the NBA are the second oldest group in professional sports, and of course, another long-in-the-toother, Phil Jackson, led the Lakers to the championship this year, age 63. Now, on the other hand, in the mean sports, it's the exact reverse. Youth rules. The Pittsburgh Penguins won the Stanley Cup behind a 38-year-old coach, Dan Bylsma. And the Pittsburgh Steelers' head whippersnapper, Mike Tomlin, won the Super Bowl at only 36. In all of Major League Baseball, only one manager is in his 30s, while in the NFL, only two are barely in their 60s. The average NFL coach is a full 6 years younger than his baseball counterpart. It's a weird dichotomy, isn't it? Perhaps baseball managers are older because the sport has more of a hierarchy with the minor leagues. You have to work your way up. And also, baseball is the only sport where the managers dress just like their players. It hides their age. Everybody loves a man in uniform, even an old man.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When Barack Obama was elected president, some comics were not amused. Chris Rock called him a comedian's worst nightmare. Bill Maher said, on top of being perfect, he's black, and liberals are afraid to laugh at anything with a black person in it. But President Obama does not intimidate Second City, the comedy troupe based in his hometown of Chicago. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, Second City is in Washington with a show called Barack Stars.
Barack Stars is pretty raucous and irreverent. Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel is like a little pit bull out of control. Vice President Joe Biden is one giant run-on sentence.
But at choice moments, you'll still hear my voice, like when I told the media nobody should fly on a plane or ride a subway because of swine flu.
Swine flu.
And President Obama?
We can be what we want, and we want to be what we can.
Cast member Sam Richardson has been impersonating Barack Obama for about a year now and studying his mannerisms for even longer.
Sometimes when he speaks, he's got a little bit of Martin Luther King in his voice. So sometimes he'll you know, go,
now, what we need to do as a people is come together and achieve what we can all achieve.
But then sometimes he'll bring it way down and he'll just be talking to you and I'll say, I like what you're talking about. I understand what you're saying, but I don't think it's prudent at this time. because he's got so many nuances and he's such a dynamic figure, it's fun to play with that.
And play they do. Everyone's fair game in Barack Stars, including Barack fans.
Can Obama really turn Guantanamo into the next Six Flags?
Yes, he can. Yes, he can.
But can he really make smoking good for you?
Yes, he can. Yes, he can.
Second City's Mark Warzeka directs Barack Stars.
A lot of our Obama material is rooted in exaggeration. There's real-life Obama worship out there, and yeah, that could be a lot of fun.
Well, my boyfriend and I fight.
Obama is there to stay the night.
Barack Stars was made for a DC audience, and this crowd was into it. In fact, Second City gets a lot of its material from the audience. At the Comedy Troupe's resident stages in Chicago and Toronto, the cast will do improvisation and let the audience shout out ideas.
And most of the time, I think the audience is reflecting what's going on out there in the world today. What they read in the paper this morning, they're going to shout out at our improvisation at night, and that's going to work its way into our shows.
Take gays in the military and the policy don't ask, don't tell. This is what the real Barack Obama said in an interview with Military Times before he was elected president.
At a time when we are shorthanded, that everybody who is willing to lay down their lives on behalf of the United States and can do so effectively can perform.
At ease, soldiers! I am here to talk to you about a policy called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now, this thing's been working fine for a while, but now we gotta change it. Since we're very short-handed in certain areas of the world right now. So from now on, Don't Ask, Don't Tell will be called Don't Leave! Don't leave, please! Don't leave!
Second City is marking its 50th anniversary this year. It was founded in 1959 at the University of Chicago by young actors who wanted to do political and social satire. Its alumni is like a who's who of American comedy, from John Belushi to Tina Fey. Barack Stars is the first new show Second City has premiered in D.C. Mark Warzeka.
To get to do, you know, a whole show of Second City social and political satire in our nation's capital, in a great theater just blocks from the National Mall, is a real honor and privilege and thrill for all of us.
Barack Stars is on stage at the Woolly Mammoth Theater through early August. So far, no sign of any real Barack Stars in the audience. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
Here's one small piece of solace for California schools. Detroit has it worse. If you were leading the Detroit public schools, here are some numbers you'd have to live with. In 2002, you had 160,000 kids in the system. By next year, you expect to have 83,000. You have 104 schools, with 41 failing so badly you've just told all 2,600 teachers who work at them that they'll have to re-interview for their old jobs. The schools are flirting with Chapter 9 bankruptcy. They are, according to U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan, a national disgrace. All that is the reality for Robert Bobb, spelled B-O-B-B. He has managed cities and school systems from California to Michigan and Washington, D.C., and he is now the emergency financial director of Detroit's public schools. And given the alternatives, Robert Bobb sees the upside to bankruptcy.
It gives us an opportunity to set aside all of our labor contracts with the various labor unions that we have, that include teachers. And also it gives us an opportunity to restructure some of our debt.
You've had some pretty big corporate bankruptcies in Michigan recently. Would you prefer bankruptcy to going on with your current contracts and your debts as they're now structured?
Well, we've renegotiated with some of our creditors. I know we hear the argument that were we to choose Chapter 9 bankruptcy, it would cause great damage, as it were, to our school system's reputation. But it is one of those options that we cannot afford to dismiss as a non-option.
Mr. Bobb, given your experience in California, in Washington, D.C., elsewhere in Michigan, what is it about Detroit that strikes you as unique to Detroit and different from the experiences you've had elsewhere?
Well, what is unique here is the fact that in the other jurisdictions, they did not experience, 7 consecutive years of overspending. The other jurisdictions that I've been involved in have had a much more disciplined approach to budgeting and finance. And when revenues were reduced, they did not hesitate to go through a very rigorous process to bring expenditures in line with the revenues that were available.
And in Detroit, when revenues went down?
We continued to spend, and that's why we're in the deep financial deficit that we're in.
So you're paying the price of a city that violated what would seem to be a fairly obvious lesson, which is you can't spend what you don't have.
Candidly, the old adage of, you know, the sins of the fathers and mothers are now upon the current children of the system.
For ineptitude, for corruption, for maladministration, for what? How do you judge what you're finding there as you sift through the legacy that you're managing?
For all of those examples you've just cited, we've experienced, you know, corruption within the system. Obviously, the overspending which has taken place. This is a school system that rewarded vendors more than it rewarded children. But when it comes down to the tough decisions that would put in place systems, remove personnel, those decisions were not made. And so we're paying the price.
You're saying we love children, but we also really love our jobs, is what you...
We didn't operationalize our love for children.
Is it fixable, or have you reached a point where, I mean, you've lost... or you will have lost about 50% almost of the student population in less than a decade. The problems you've recited are just colossal. Is there some point when you just say, just go to charter schools, rethink the whole thing, shut down the public school system?
We will never shut down the public school system. The school district is fixable. It will survive and it will grow stronger. You know, we may have to grow smaller to go stronger, but it will survive.
Well, Mr. Bob, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Robert. Appreciate it.
Robert Bob, who is the emergency financial manager of the Detroit Public Schools.
Ben Bernanke's language also gets a good deal of scrutiny. The Federal Reserve Chairman is on Capitol Hill this week seeking to reassure lawmakers about the state of the economy. He told them yesterday that as the economy begins to recover, the Fed will be on the lookout for inflation and has the tools to fight it. NPR's John Itzde has more.
Bernanke will spend his second day on Capitol Hill providing lawmakers with the Fed's twice-yearly assessment of the U.S. economy. Yesterday, he told members of the House Financial Services Committee that there are some glimmers of hope. The rate of decline in the economy has slowed significantly, he said, and there are signs of stabilization. But he warned the country is still in for a long haul.
Because even though if the economy begins to turn up in terms of production, unemployment is going to stay high for quite a while, and so it's not going to feel like a really strong economy.
Bernanke also addressed the concerns of lawmakers and investors that the Fed will leave stimulative monetary policy in place too long and spark damaging inflation. Florida Congressman Bill Posey was among those expressing concern.
Certainly, unless that money gets sucked back in, and out of circulation, it's going to cause inflation. There's no denying it.
If it's not sucked back in, but as I was describing, we have ways of sucking it back in.
Bernanke did acknowledge that choosing the right time to remove the stimulus will be challenging.
It's a very difficult problem. Even though we have these unusual circumstances, it's really the same problem we always face, which you just pointed out, is picking the right moment to begin to tighten and picking the appropriate pace of tightening.
Given the depths of the recession, Bernanke suggested the time for tightening is still a long way off. In fact, he also got questions like this one from Delaware Republican Michael Castle about whether a second congressional stimulus package is needed.
Would you agree with that? I mean, I've heard your reference to the fact that the first stimulus is still being spent out there and has a long ways to go.
Yeah, I think it's very early. Less than a quarter of the first stimulus has been spent. We'll have to see how the economy evolves. So I think it's premature to make any judgments about that.
Chairman Bernanke also told lawmakers it's time for them to put a plan in place to rein in the unsustainable spending that's driven deficits above $1 trillion annually. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Here in California, details continue to emerge about the proposed new budget. The legislature is poised to vote on it as soon as tomorrow. On top of massive cutbacks in state programs and services, the budget deal relies on some questionable accounting tricks. And here to talk about them is Philip Romero. He's dean of the College of Business and Economics at Cal State Los Angeles. He was also California's chief economist under Republican Governor Pete Wilson in the 1990s, and he witnessed firsthand the last big budget meltdown in 1992. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, let's talk about these accounting gimmicks in this budget. What are they?
Well, first thing I should say is that this budget is being revealed step by step. The legislative leadership are keeping a lot of it under wraps because in the first law of politics is that once you reveal the details, you create a lot more targets for opponents to shoot at. And so they've revealed very little thus far. But I've seen two kinds of gimmicks already. The first is a very simple thing. They're moving the last payroll of the year from June 30th to July 1st. And so therefore, it will hit against next year's budget, not this year's budget. So that's a classic gimmick. Second kind of gimmick is that they are borrowing extensively from other jurisdictions. The state funds K through 12 schools and cities and counties substantially, and they are choosing to basically expropriate those funds under a nominal loan for several years, which means the state will have to pay it back with interest later.
And how are they allowed to do that? I mean, it sounds like the first one, at least, sounds like just, as you say, a blatant trick. And how would that pass muster with the accountants?
It is a blatant trick, and it is absolutely business as usual for the state. Tricks like this have been used routinely, probably in two-thirds of the budgets that have been passed in the last 20 years. Government jurisdictions are held to very different accounting standards, lamentably are held to very different accounting standards from private companies. So this goes on all the time.
And you mentioned the money used to pay for education. Part of the problem with that is Proposition 13, which was passed in the 1970s, and that greatly capped property taxes, which in other places is what pays for the majority of public education.
That's absolutely correct. And after Prop 13 was passed in 1978, because that greatly reduced the traditional funding source that cities and counties and school districts use, as you mentioned, the state then, quote-unquote, backfilled. It committed to providing state general revenues to backfill. And periodically, when the state general revenues decline drastically, as they do in most recessions, especially including this one, they then suspend that offer. And cities, counties, and school districts are going to be grappling with collectively close to $6 billion in reduced revenues. So as the LA Times put it today, essentially the state has outsourced accountability.
Now, this budget crisis is hitting you and your students directly. Tuition at Cal State is going up, and most Cal State workers, including you, will be furloughed 2 days a month and see their pay cut by 10%. So I imagine you are following all this with special interest.
I think most about our students. We've been obliged to cancel a number of classes. And because of the long delay in the state budget being passed, sometimes we had to do it with virtually no warning. This is a special problem for Cal State students on any campus because our essential mission is to educate the working class, to give them entry into the middle class. And many of these kids work one, two, three jobs, have great difficulty completing their curriculum and graduating in a reasonable amount of time. And this state budget is just putting additional barriers in their way.
Philip Romero is dean of the College of Business and Economics at Cal State LA. Thank you very much.
Thank you.